Good evening, and welcome to another episode of Nigeria Politics Weekly. As usual, my name is Michael, and co-hosting with me is Phoenix. Today, we have two guests. Our first guest is Ilemona. Ilemona is a member, is a lawyer, member of the PDP's People's Democratic Party, and was also a member of the PDP's Presidential Campaign Council in the last elections, the 2023 presidential elections. Our second guest is Eluka. Eluka is a trade finance specialist. Now, Phoenix.
Thank you very much for having us, Michael.
Yes, thank you all for coming. We have three topics. Sorry, listeners, I almost forgot to tell you that we had three topics. We have three topics to discuss today. The first topic of discussion will be the Supreme Court's ruling on the 2023 presidential elections. The second topic we'll discuss is the retirement of one of the Supreme Court justices, Justice Dattijo. And upon retirement, he issued harsh criticisms of his brother justices, and we'll be discussing the contents of his criticisms. The third topic of discussion will be Nigeria's victory at the UK Commercial Courts in the disp in the case of P and ID versus Nigeria. So to our first topic, Phoenix. Phoenix, President Bola Ahmed Tinubu has now been confirmed as President of Nigeria. Are you now at peace? Are you now satisfied that the law has run its course and we now have a president on seat and therefore you must congratulate him, Phoenix? Is that your position?
Hi, Michael, and thanks, Eluqua and Elimona, for joining us this week. Really glad to have you guys back. Hi, listeners. Michael, you want to start this podcast this week? We're looking for my trouble. Well, let me put everything you have said in perspective. Yes, I am satisfied that our legal process as regarding elections has run its course. We've gotten to the apex court, a decision has been made, and that's it. We move on and abide by that decision that's been made, in I mean, with respect to democracy, rule of law, and everything that we think should be right about this country. It is not a judgment that I agree with. I don't see it as a positive outcome. And I will not be congratulating Tinubu. I do not see him as a legitimate president in my eyes. The process has been followed, and he is the substantive president of Nigeria. And so he can carry on the business of governance doing what he needs to do, but he will certainly not be getting my congratulations. He hasn't done anything to earn it. As far as I'm concerned, he only brings disrepute to the office. But I am a Democrat. We follow democratic process, and this is where we are for the next 4 years.
Sorry, Phoenix, I need some further clarification. Why, despite the ruling of the Supreme Court, are you refusing to congratulate the president? Are you saying the judges did not deliver a fair ruling? Is that your position?
Well, leading up to the judgment, I had always said that I was 50-50 looking forward to this judgment. And what I had always wanted to see is a judgment that is based on clear judicial principles, clear a clearly addressing the matter at hand. And most importantly for me, I said it repeatedly on the podcast, elevating the discussion beyond, it was three parties in this case, but two sides, raising a dispute over something. This is a matter of national importance. This is about the presidential elections and choosing a leader for 4 years to run a country of 200 million people. This is about the outcome of an election that supposedly about 25, 26 million people took part in, where the declared winner did not only won about 36% of the votes. This was a very important, and therefore, when you say somebody won 36%, it means that 64% did not vote for the person. So I expected that our Supreme Court will take all this into context and decide to make judgment based on a clear visit of the issues one by one, and making sure that, whenever whatever they pronounce is not going to be based on technicalities. But that's what they decided to do. So as far as I'm concerned, they haven't delivered a fair judgment. Let's not even begin to talk about the fact that they rushed the process, and then the outcome it simply makes no sense. So, I mean, again, by our constitution and submitting ourselves to the rule of law, because there must be reason. We must have order. We have said that these people in this court will be the final arbiter, and they've given their judgments, and that's it. We will live by that. But the judgment, I must say, made no sense to me, and still makes no sense to me. They have not dispensed justice as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you, Phoenix. Ilamuna, you're a member of the People's Democratic Party. So my question to you is in two parts. The first part is, has your party congratulated the president? And if not, why not? And the second question, Ilamuna, is on the three key issues that the court was supposed to rule on. The first was this drama over Bola Tinubu's academic certificate or degree certificate from Chicago State University. The second was on the question of Abuja, whether Tinubu needed to win 25% of the votes in Abuja. And thirdly, the relevance of IREV to the election results. Do you agree with the Supreme Court's ruling on those three issues? So, yes, to Lemon and my two-part question.
Okay, hi again, Phoenix. First things first. I'm not aware that the party congratulated President Bola Tinubu. I'm not aware that the party intends to congratulate President Bola Tinubu. For that matter, well, I don't believe that anybody should be doing so. He's won now won in quote an election off the back of the insistence of the Supreme Court. And many of us believe that that insistence, that pronouncement is questionable. Yes, we trained as a lawyer. We have to come to a point where there must be an end to litigation. We've come to that end to litigation. So for the purposes of officialdom, there's nothing anybody can do about it. He will see out at least one term of 4 years. But there are substantial questions regarding processes, the substantial re questions regarding the substance, the merit of the judgment before that was given by the Supreme Court. So, to answer the first part of your question, I'm not aware that the PDP has congratulated him, and I'm not aware that the PDP intends to congratulate him. I know that President, Vice President, former Vice President Atiku Abubakar will have a press conference, I think by 4 p.m. tomorrow, where a lot of the issues will be, addressed. But at this time, I don't know that there's a, I mean, whether we congratulate him or not, is neither here nor there. He has a country to run now, and he's done a very terrible job in his first 6 months, like we predicted he would. He has 3 years and 6 months to salvage something from what is left of the ruins of the country that he has currently superintended us into. Now, to come to your second question about three key issues, there was one of those issues was slam dunk. And if you checked at the hearing, when and even at the judgment, when people started making, there were some questions asked by the Lord Justices of the Supreme Court that can maybe give you the feeling that there was a predetermined conclusion. I'm not going to cast any aspersions on the Justices of the Supreme Court, but I would think that the Justices of the Supreme Court, in the first place, not only erred in law, but they also erred in fact. It is common knowledge that the Supreme Court can accept evidence at this stage, fresh evidence, if that evidence did not exist before. There's a 2011 case, Uzodinma versus Izuna. So I will supply, when you post the podcast link, I will supply the citation to that case. I will supply it once you post the podcast link. In Uzodinma versus Izuna, so Chief Wole Olanipekun, SAN, who was the lead counsel to the respondents in this article and others versus Abian and others versus INEC and others, or versus Bola Tinubu and others. Chief Wole Olanipekun approached the Supreme Court and argued that evidence, particularly the extract of a PDP NWC meeting, which had held in January, was not available to him until I think it was April. And so once he got that was fresh evidence strengthening his case several months later, and he presented that before the court and argued for the Supreme Court to accept it. Now, in accepting that argument, the Supreme Court said that it was important to lend credence to the fact of, one, that evidence wasn't available to the appellants in that case until sometime in April, by which time trials had been completed in the court of first instance, and then in the court of first instance and the court of appeal. So he had to bring it fresh to the Supreme Court. There was another thing. They said, okay, so one, the evidence was new, was fresh, it was novel. Two, it was compelling and it was important to the matter at hand. It did not mean that it had to be successful. All that it required was that it had to be important. And then three, there was a third, I can't remember what the third thing is. Now, in both cases, on both grounds, with both principles in Atiku's appeal, it was the same thing. That evidence, the evidence of CSU's deposition, was not available until the day before we filed at the Supreme Court. Until the day before we filed at the Supreme Court. So I don't understand how you defer on the principle. Was it important to the arguments before the court? Again, yes. The Lords erred in fact when they said that Atiku did not plead the facts of Bola Tinubu's forgery. It was one of the facts of the petition. It was one of the petition at the court of first instance. It was one of the facts of the petition of the appeal before the Supreme Court. So it wasn't that the evidence that we sought to adduce was floating in the air. It was tied to a ground for appeal. It was tied to one of the issues formulated for appeal. So it leaves a sour taste in the mouth, you know, to see that sort of categorization and then the harsh words. And then when the judges are making statements and they say to you, oh, that the standard of proof is beyond reasonable doubt. And I mean, we heard that at the hearing of the appeal, not at the judgment. We heard that at the hearing of the appeal. I beg to differ. The Supreme Court itself has said that the standard of appeal is very simple, the preponderance of evidence. Established. All you need to do is establish that there was forgery. We're not making any criminal allegations. Hence, there was no need to go into questions of actus reus and mens rea, or to try him for the purposes of securing a conviction The standard of proof of proving beyond reasonable doubt is for criminal matters. This was not a criminal matter. It was an electoral matter. To then, you know, raise issues of standard of proof and so on. But then again, at the end of the day, you know how they say it, as the court pleases. If you go to the other two issues, about 25%, and then the final issue about, I'm sorry, what was that final issue again? 25%, and then there was something else.
The IREV portal, the relevance of the IREV portal to the electoral process.
It goes, with respect to the IREV portal, I would quickly like to argue, okay, let's go back and correct that, correct the law. I disagree with the judges of the court of the Supreme Court, but it is that, from to my mind, is subsidiary legislation to the Constitution. So we can say, okay, maybe there were loopholes that we have seen exploited, but on the issue of qualification, it was a constitutional issue. I would like to place far more credence on the issue of forgery and qualification. It was a constitutional issue. It is a constitutional issue. Now, what the Supreme Court has done is they've just kicked the can down the road. In 4 years, we're going to be here. There was a very interesting judgment that was given by the Supreme Court in Hassan Saleh versus Christian Abba. Yeah, it's a case in Benue State where one of the arguments was a person had presented a forged certificate. Now, he had presented a forged certificate in the 2011 elections, and then in the 2015 elections, he had removed that certificate and submitted only. So I think he presented a forged university certificate in 2011, and then in 2015 had removed that forged certificate and only pleaded, he only submitted a lesser qualification. He only submitted his secondary school. Now, the Supreme Court held that the question is, have you ever, the question on the INEC forms is, have you ever submitted a forged certificate to INEC? And that anybody who answers yes is barred from contesting elections for all time. It shouldn't be restricted solely to that particular electoral cycle, but that at any point that you are able to affirm that one person has submitted a forged certificate, from that day onwards till the end of time, that person should never be able to contest an election in the country. So we already have weapons in our armory against the 2027 elections. And since the Supreme Court and our judiciary has refused to discuss the merits, to determine on the merits in 2023, they will have to determine on the merits in 2027. Because our argument at that time will be, having submitted, now we have substantiated, we have it in, we have evidence of it in living color, having substantiated that this thing is forged, should this man not be disqualified? And at that point, we'll be arguing it as a pre-election issue. So I think that all they've done is kick the can down the road. At some point down the road, we're still going to meet that can.
Thank you very much, Lemona. Eluka, the question for you, being a man in engaging in international businesses, what do you think the implications are for Nigeria's reputation, where, for example, a university has clearly indicated that the president appeared to have submitted a forged certificate, but the Supreme Court refuses to rule on the issue and relies on technicalities, or the fact that prior to the elections, all Nigerians were told that the elections results will be uploaded to the IREV portal and those processes would be binding, or will be the sole determinant of how results are counted. And then the Supreme Court also skirts around that issue. Yeah. Are there any reputational implications for Nigeria's legal system, Eluka?
Thank you very much. Hi, everyone. Well, I mean, if you do business internationally, you know that Nigeria is considered a high-risk country. So when you look at all the parameters, personal parameters, political, legal, you know, we've always been considered high risk. So What I see clearly is that this issue will compound the way people view us internationally. So, I mean, it's clear. Now, if we have a president who, from a disposition by CSU, says that the certificate they submitted for the president submitted to INEC was not from the university, it's red flag. So now, how does it, how what would be the outcome? Because we're discussing decisions, but we've not been able to say this is the outcome for Nigeria and for Nigerians. One, everything from Nigeria is going to be heavily scrutinized. So I can say that as from what has happened, because I mean you're dealing with the global village, money risk managers, money compliance managers, they follow the news. So it's funny, you might not see them come out and say, oh, this is what happened in Nigeria. But at every particular point in time, they follow news and activities for countries they deem high risk. Nigeria is deemed high risk. So already you've seen what has happened in Canada. Canada only has a new requirement for people coming to study here, where they need to verify your admission letter. So we're going to keep on getting scrutinized, but the scrutiny is going to increase. When you look at the legal framework, you're going to see people trying to get, when they come to enter into contracts or agreement with Nigerian businesses, you're going to see them ring fence their legal agreements. Because if the people don't have to, I mean, if your justice system cannot deliver justice based on the meat of the matter, but this relies on practicalities, it goes to say that, I mean, you can apply this into business relationships. You can apply this situation into enforcing contracts, And so it's quite unfortunate that our judiciary or our justice system has not been able to deliver justice. And I keep on telling them that the reason why we all agree to live under one common constitution, despite our reservation, is to believe in a system that no matter how bad it is, you can always get justice. Justice is the fulcrum of great societies. When you talk about the West, justice is the fulcrum. And so, I mean, it's going to be tough for Nigerians.
Thank you, Aluka. I've just got two more questions. The first will be to you, Aluka, again. As Elemona has said, and Phoenix has said, they have the view that there's no basis for congratulating the president because they don't think the Supreme Court has reached the right decision. However, there have been members of the opposition party who have already congratulated the president. For example, we have the likes of Senator Ben Bruce, who was a prominent supporter of Atiku. He's already come forward to congratulate the president. So, what do you think is happening here, Eluka? Eluka, are you there? Eluka,
Was that me
you're.
or a local you were asking?
Aluka, sorry, that was a question for, sorry, a question for Lemona. Lemona, a quick question to you on Ben Bruce. Sorry, not Aluka.
Oh, sorry. Ask me the question again. I thought you were talking to Eluka.
No, I was going to say the question is you and Felix have both said there's no basis for congratulating the president because you don't believe that he won fairly. But your party, some of your party members, and I can think of, for example, Senator Ben Bruce, or even Nyesom Wike, who is even a minister in this government, they've all congratulated your president. We've seen the governor of Bayelsa State, for example, he was actually in Aso Rock congratulating the president, and the Bayelsa governor is a member of your party. So, how do you respond to these, Ilamola?
I think that if they congratulate President Bola Tinubu, again, to my mind, it's neither here nor there. He's president whether people congratulate him or not. So it's neither here nor there. He doesn't, the only reason why he's so, or his supporters are so stuck in seeking congratulations is because everybody is aware that there's an air of a lack of legitimacy around the man, and they only want us to congratulate him to confer illegitimacy of the will of the people upon him that does not exist. That's the only reason why they are stuck up, seeking for congratulations and endorsements, simply because it will confer upon him, you know, legitimacy of the will of the people, of the will of the majority of the people that he does not have. So, like I believe, it's neither here nor there. It doesn't matter whether I congratulate him or not, whether Atiku congratulates him or not, or whoever. He's going to be president of the Federal Republic of Nigeria for the next 4 years. Now, if individuals within the party, is it right that they have to, if they choose to do, congratulate him? In the same way, it's the right that individuals also have not to congratulate him. Whether they are members, whether they're being members of the political party does not stop them from being individuals, does not take their agency as individuals. So if they choose to do so on their own, oh, well and good. Nobody can stop them from doing so. What I do not know, and I've asked around, I do not know if the party has an intention. I'm not aware of the party having an intention to congratulate him. But like I say, that is all. It really doesn't matter. Right now, he's received the final seal of approval from the nation's highest court. He has a country to run. He, rather than, you know, be on this quest where he and where his supporters are looking for legitimacy, can he just run the country? We've got an economic crisis. We've got a currency crisis. We've got an agricultural crisis. We've got an educational crisis. We've got a security crisis. We've got a healthcare crisis. Focus on those important things. They should forget about these things about who congratulated and who didn't congratulate. It's the right of Nigerian people, if they so choose to exercise, to either give congratulations or refrain from giving those congratulations. It is also the right of the Nigerian people to demand that they are governed properly, to demand accountability, whether or not they voted for the government in power. So it is. You should just get to work and forget all those things are big. And like I said, his 6 months in power thus far have shown us a lack of preparation to govern this country. We've seen the implementation of incoherent plans. We're seeing policy flip-flops. We're seeing announcements and withdrawal of appointments. We're seeing... The impression is a group of people who did not prepare for office. Now they don't have the excuse of a distraction anymore. Can they focus and get to work and leave us alone whether we want to congratulate them or not? That's not their business.
Thank you, Lemona. Phoenix, on to our second topic, which also concerns the Supreme Court. This time, the retiring Supreme Court judge, Justice Datijo Muhammad, issued a scathing criticism of the courts, Phoenix. Can you talk us through the Justice Datijo's grievances, Phoenix, and what do you think has triggered them? Phoenix, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Hi. It was quite interesting. So he was having his valedictory session as he was bowing out of service, having reached the mandatory age of 70, and the man decided to use it to express views that he obviously had been stewing on for a while. I think the timing of it was even more interesting because we've just been discussing a Supreme Court judgment that, quite frankly, anyone who was in Nigeria would have seen the mood of the country and seen that it was not a celebratory mood. So it was clear that the majority of Nigerians did not take a liking to the judgment. So the man took a, it was an auspicious time for the man to come out and speak about the, for me, the theme was the failings of the judiciary at large. And he raised a multitude of points, which just pointed to the fact that we have a, I think dysfunctional will be putting it quite lightly. We have a deliberately debased judiciary. And it starts at the very top, because the things he was talking about really impacted the Supreme Court itself and the Niger and the National Judiciary Council, which is, you know, the body that has oversight on the judiciary, with the Chief Justice of the Federation at its head as the chairman. A number of things I'll speak to, and of course I'm sure we will get through as well, was something that had already reared its head when the matter had gone from PEPT to Supreme Court. It was the starting point was the constitution of the Supreme Court itself. I mean, I'm talking about the number of justices that are available at the Supreme Court. I believe they're supposed to be 24. As of now, with Justice Dasijo's retirement, and not to forget that Justice Augie had also recently retired, I think there are about 10 justices left. Now, imagine that we were going into the PEPT, and at that time, you need seven justices to sit on a panel for it to be legally constituted. And we had only 10, between 9 and 10, if I remember correctly. So you could already see he was speaking to the fact that, number one, the court is not correctly constituted. And the reason why it is not correctly constituted is because the Chief Justice, who has the authority to lead the NJC, which makes the recommendations to the president to appoint judges and justices, and especially justices to the Supreme Court, was deliberately refusing to fill certain seats because it will bring, you know, to marginalize certain sections of the country. He talked about the fact that there has been no person of Southeast extraction appointed to the Supreme Court since the last member from that region had died 2 years ago. He talked about the fact that with him retiring, there will be no representation from the North Central, which I'm sure my friend Lemon would also be reacting to. And the fact that the other four regions at least were represented, minimum of two people. I believe he said that Northwest and Southwest have three each, South-South and Northeast have two each. So you see a deliberate self-harm to the court and the nation at large, but through political means, which you would expect will not be coming into the court. So that was one big thing that he was talking about, because that really creates issues for the country. Then he talked about nepotism. He talked about, you know, a range of other topics, you know, that just exposed all of what we've been saying about the fact that, and last week we were talking about it, and we're saying, look, if you look at it, Nigerians are losing faith in the electoral process. Nigerians believe that they are not able to choose their leaders, whether to the executive or the legislative arms. And that's why it was very important to have the judiciary step up to the plate and help course correct, because that's the last stand, right? That let's make sure that the judiciary addresses this petition, election petitions from a point of law, based on fact, and you know, do justice, because that might help us, you know, win back some of that trust. But we now see why that was not possible and why the outcome was inevitable, because the court itself has been corrupted. The court itself is operating in a manner that is fit for the political sphere that it is supposed to be over and above of, to make sure that, you know, there is fairness and equity across the land. So again, I say it was an auspicious time. Some have, you know, some have cynically said, why did he wait till this time and blah, blah, blah. He could have said something earlier. It doesn't matter whether he waited or he did not wait. That's for his own conscience. The fact that he could, at least he could have retired without saying anything, and he chose to say something, I applaud him for that, because at least he puts the pressure now on Chief Justice Ariwola and his colleagues to now see how he intends to, you know, fill the remaining 14 seats and in what time frame, and what then happens going forward. I believe it rightfully puts the spotlight on the judiciary, and let's see where it takes us from here.
Thank you. If I could jump in there, I would like to do two things. First, a small correction. The constitutional requirement is a maximum of 21, not 24.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Lima.
Yeah. Maximum. And then to pick up from there, it is important to put Justice Datijo's comments in the context of comments that other people have made in the very recent past. I will start from the former senator who was, I think from what state now, APC senator, husband to the former president of the Court of Appeal, Senator Boka Chua. Remember at the valedictory session of the last Senate, of the ninth Senate, remember his comments where he said that, you know, my wife has been able to help influence decisions in favor of, you know, remember that. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, remember the recent comment made by Elisha Abbo, that the current Senate president used the judiciary to get him out of office because he'd not submitted his ambition. Those two, when you take those two statements into consideration, then you hear Justice Datijo's comments made as an insider at the highest levels of our judiciary. He just retired as the second oldest member of the Supreme Court. So what the three things combined tell you is a very disturbing, very disturbing notion that the Supreme Court has lost. You know how we say that the will of the people, the National Assembly represents the will of the people. The Supreme Court ought to represent our soul. It ought to represent the very heartbeat for the application of our laws impartially to whoever, you know. When Justice Datijo speaks about the unpredictability of the judgments that come out from the Supreme Court, ordinarily, you should be able to predict that if this set of facts are applied before the Supreme Court, this will be the judgment. You should be able to do so. We're going to a Supreme Court where everybody goes heart in mouth, because you don't know. Despite several years, you will be able to point to jurisprudence from our Supreme Court, going back decades even, of consistency. But we've gotten to the point where our political judgments are all over the place, conflicting. You see, simple issues. Oh, this is a pre-election issue. That is a post-election issue. And then it varies depending on the parties before the court, depending on their political leanings, and so on and so forth. And it feels like the country has lost its soul. It really does feel that. I can imagine the level of concern that Justice Dadjio must have experienced that made him say, you know what, this must be said. And the accusations that he laid out quite a number of accusations. In many cases, pointing out fingers directly at the CJN, who was seated right next to him. The CJN was seated right next to him. And he said, hold on, this, we ought not to, in a normal country, we would be on the streets. In a normal country, there would be pressure. In a normal country, this would have led to a very large investigation, including calling on Justice Dadjio himself. Don't give us the specifics. You make very grave allegations of bribery and corruption. Substantiate them. If you know judgments that were procured on anything other than the facts and the principles of law before you, substantiate them. Let us bring everything out in the open. It is only in the transparency of openness that we will be able to begin the hard work of reclaiming and reforming our judicial system. And then finally, one of the things that he points out that really worries me is the workload that the judges have to deal with. At the moment, every case that is filed in this country, from the upper area court to the magistrates' courts to the high courts to wherever, can all, depending on the resources of the litigants, can all get to the Supreme Court. So already there was a very big workload if they were 21. We haven't had the Supreme Court have a full complement of justices for years. So there's already a huge workload. That workload means that everybody but the politicians have secured themselves an amendment to our constitution, an amendment to our electoral acts that gives them a maximum time frame within which judgment must be given. But that doesn't apply to criminals, to people who are waiting trial for crimes that they may or may not have committed. That does not apply to our commercial disputes that form the bedrock of our economic activity. That does not apply to all sorts family law cases and all of that. So we have a bench at that level. And this is often the case also elsewhere. We don't always have a full complement of judges of the state high courts. We don't always have a full complement of judges of the federal high court. We don't always have a full complement of the judges of the Court of Appeal. We haven't had a full complement of judges at the Supreme Court for years. Because of that, they are overstaffed, they are understaffed, and they are overburdened with the sheer number of cases that they have to deal with. The fallout is that Nigerians, Nigerian businesses, Nigerian families suffer an inordinate amount of suffering while we're waiting for judgment to come out at that level. So, as much as we must get the politics right, yeah, we must also, for the best interests of our legal system and the people who appear before it, we must also, as quickly as possible, get the full complement of the judges of the justices of the Supreme Court so we can get speedier dispensation of justice for the people who so dearly need it. At the moment, the only people who get that is the politicians. That cannot be so. That cannot be right.
Thank you, Ilemona. Let me bring in Eluka at this point. Eluka, you made some interesting arguments on social media when Justice Dadjio's comments were published. And you referred to the fact that the only time Nigeria seems to unite is when they want to show their contempt for the Igbos. Do you think the exclusion of the Southeast from judicial appointments was an attempt to marginalize the Southeast, or do you think it was more inadvertent, Eluka?
So, to be very honest, I mean, to go to that statement, this is what everybody had known. I mean, these are conversations you have in your pubs, with your friends about wrath in the judiciary. And so when you make those statements, you don't really have faith, but you just look at anecdote and say, okay, why can't Nigerians get justice? Like Eleven has said, why can't we trust our judicial system? And so you make those statements and say, I mean, Nigerian judiciary are just like that. But again, for me, what that you're saying is it's interesting because this is the same thing the layman on the street says. So you can imagine when a Supreme Court justice says the same thing all of us says, he tells you the wrath is deeper. I mean, the wrath must have been so bad that even just the justice that you couldn't stand it again. Because we grew up listening to judges. I had an uncle who was a judge, and his life was peculiar because the thing tells you that you must stand upright. So for you to judge on matters of life and death, the people must believe that you have the right temperament and you have the moral standing to be able to decide on those matters. Now, to your question, again, it is not what I said, it's what that you just said. Clearly, that you just said that it was a deliberate effort by the Supreme Court Chief Justice Nigeria, not to nominate a justice from the Southeast. So it wasn't what I said. It is just what we all know. So clearly, hearing it from someone who's not from the Southeast, who is from the North Central, who is also a Supreme Court justice, echoing what everybody says, it tells you that you don't need to plot any graph to know this was an intention, this was intentional. And I mean, we say it, I mean, I say those things and I move on. I don't take it to heart because I understand what Nigeria is. I mean, but the good news is that it is now irritating people who are not from the Southeast who feel, I mean, this is now too much. I mean, I'm going to end by saying that Nigeria is a problem. There's a small problem with that because it looks like they have a lot of people in authority who are hardcore tribalists. And I don't know how we're going to unwind this situation, but it's a very, very risky situation for Nigeria. I hope our politicians understand what they are playing.
Thank you, Aluka. I need to get some further clarification on this point. So the question is, why do you think, or why in particular, is it the Southeast that is being discriminated against? What do you think is the reasoning behind it, or the motivation behind it?
Well, I mean, nobody can really explain what the motivation is. What you can always explain is the obvious truth. Now, I mean, from what I heard from that Joe, for you to constitute a panel, there has to be equal representation. And so, what we've seen after the death and retirement of some justices from thousands of that, the Supreme Chief Justice of Nigeria knew fully well that if you constitute a panel today, you will not get equal representation. Knowing fully well that the Southeast has no justice on the bench, Supreme Court justice on the bench again, still went ahead to constitute panels, knowing again that this panel does not satisfy the logic of equal representation. So I can go on to infer that even the Supreme Court panel that heard the appeal, or that heard the appeal of the PDP candidate and the Labour candidate was not should have been disbanded, should not even have been consisted because it did not give each zone in the federation equal representation. And so there's always this argument that, well, most of the things people say from the Southern states are anecdotal, there's no evidence. But time again, you can always predict the behavior of people because you know why? History does not lie. I could come up and say, this is what's going to happen. Ah, no, we are clearly beaten. At the end of the day, what you see happens, and people say, okay, it was coincidence. Oh, it was this. I mean, no, don't take my word from it. Take the word of the man who sat on the bench for 40 years. Take the word of the man who was a fellow Supreme Court judge telling you that the reason why Ariwoola, Chief Justice Nigeria, did not appoint someone from the Southeast was deliberate. And so I'm inferring clearly that Ariwoola did not appoint anyone from the south because he did not want anyone to challenge the status quo. You know, and, I mean, for me, I find it unfortunate, you know, but this is what Nigeria is. You know, Nigeria is where hope comes to die. Nigeria is where you have a justice system that cannot deliver justice for the common man. Let me not point this clear. It cannot be that only politicians benefit from the justice system. The justice system is what keeps the rich and the powerful in check. The justice system is what gives the man on the street hope that no matter your standing in society, that we all collectively have agreed that this is where we will go to receive justice, and that without favor, without any, without biases, you, rich, poor, Christian, Muslim, straight, gay, can move to this justice, this system, and pay justice. If the Nigerian justice system is not fulfilling these purposes, then there is no point for us to say we believe in the constitution of Nigeria, or there's no point for people to say we believe that this is a great nation, because a great nation has to be great to everyone, not just to politicians or rich people or wealthy people or the upper class. A nation has to show that it is all-encompassing. It is there to fulfill the dignity of every citizen of the Federation.
Thank you, Eluka. Now we must go to our last topic because of time. Phoenix, it's another legal issue, but this time it happened, the drama is taking place in England, not in Nigeria. The UK commercial courts have delivered their ruling in the P.I.&D. suit, ruling in favor of Nigeria. Now, Phoenix, can you give us a brief overview of the background to this case and why the court's ruling is important?
I think it's important for a number of reasons, particularly as we've been talking about the Nigerian judicial system, and especially the ruling that we've just seen and Justice Datijo's comments. And then you see an outcome in a UK court where the judge is at pains to show his clear thinking, which is what we've been talking about, you know, picking the facts of the case, you know, going to precedents, talking about points of law. Are we asking for too much? But to your first question around, you know, the background of the story, this whole kerfuffle started with P&ID signing making a proposal to the government back in between 2008 and 2009, Nigerian government around building gas processing facilities and receiving wet gas from Nigeria, which it will process, refine, and then deliver back to Nigeria to enable us, you know, improve our power generation, which was a big issue, as everyone would know back then. So the whole idea, you know, Nigeria had set up a gas master plan under Yar'Adua. The intent was to improve our power situation. They were looking to gas, which we know we have a lot of that in Nigeria, which is some of it is being flared and we are losing the benefit. And a lot of it is still in large deposits across the country. So they were looking to use that. Now, this company called P&ID had been operating in Nigeria in different guises, and I'd actually started a project working with Theophilos Danjuma and his oil company on a project which was initially supposed to be in Lagos. They tried to then propose that to the Nigerian government, but, you know, as conversations were going on and on, they finally reached an agreement, you know, at the time that Rilwan Lukman was the Minister for Petroleum. So this was around early 2010, just before, I think just around the time that, Yar'Adua died, or just before he became public that he died, just before that. But he was obviously incommunicado, and Lukman signed the contract, and so he began. Now, one of the things in the contract that was signed was that there was a clause there that had been put into the agreement, which put Nigeria on the hook for the agreement if we did not supply the gas, regardless of whether this guy's actually built any facilities or not. As the evidence has now shown, the guys could not secure funding to build these facilities. Some other conversations were going on in government, because by that time Yar'Adua had died. We had Jonathan had taken over. We had a new government. They were obviously looking at some of these things and were looking to go in a different direction. And by 2012, PNID obviously could not deliver, but had already were also in cahoots with certain people in the government, and they decided that Nigeria had breached the terms of the agreement and decided to go to arbitration. When they went to arbitration, they were awarded $6 billion in damages with an interest rate of 7% if Nigeria did not settle. By the time this happened, by the time the arbitration came to an end, I think, I'm trying to remember my timelines now. I think the government had then transitioned to the Buhari government, who then refused to settle it. And they even refused to address it early enough, such that there was, I mean, the judgment, the I don't want to call it a judgment, it was a tribunal, it was an arbitration tribunal that then levied the amount that was supposed to be paid, before they then went back to court and said, no, they will not pay this, they will fight this. There was bribery, there was corruption, which, as we have it now, the judge who then, looked at the case has decided that, yes, indeed, there was impropriety. Yes, indeed, that PNID did not show capability or intent to deliver on their side of the contract, that there was already a that the agreement that was signed had a lot of irregularities, that the right authorities did not approve it. So the guy went through the different cases and ruled in favor of Nigeria, and said that, and setting aside this $6 billion, which is a great, great win for Nigeria. I mean, bear in mind that, I mean, an out-of-court settlement was mooted at some point, where we could have settled for maybe about $2 billion, and these guys will have walked away with plenty money. So it's a credit to the Buhari administration. I can't imagine myself saying that. I'm sure you'll be wondering what's wrong with Phoenix today, but this was a good outcome in the sense that they obviously had, enough to go on, and they believed that they could overturn this. And so to see that it actually came to pass, it's good to see Buhari be able to take one W for the 8 years of disaster that he gave us. But this was a very good outcome for Nigeria.
Thank you, Phoenix, for giving us the background to the issues or to the case. Now, Ilemona, as you know, you were one of the people who criticized the Buhari administration at the time for its failure to negotiate a settlement and instead take the risk of going to court. And to be fair to you, I myself also criticized Buhari for doing that, for not pursuing negotiations. But looking back and or reflecting on the fact that he was right, do you take back your criticisms, or do you think do you stand by your previous position?
I take back my, I mean, very quickly. I mean, as soon as the noise, the news of the judgment broke in a few days ago, I immediately took back my criticism. Very same place where I heard my criticisms, I went back there to say, oh, I was wrong, he was right. It does appear that a broken clock can be right twice, a day, and that this is one of few things that he got right while he was in office. But then again, we must also admit, and I will draw a similarity here, we must also admit that based on the evidence available at the time, it was perhaps the negotiated settlement was perhaps the better option at the time. Remember, Phoenix, in your recount of history, one of the things that you omitted was that when the matter was referred for arbitration, Nigeria didn't show up to arbitration at all. The judgment was given in our absence because, I mean, I can't remember now whether it was the Buhari administration, but the Nigerian the team of lawyers that was supposed to represent us at the arbitration simply did not show up. So judgment was given in default against us. Now, typically, arbitration judgments are typically final and are not usually subject to appeal. So when a negotiated $800 million settlement was reached, as opposed to the payment of a $6.6 billion award, it did seem like the better option at the time. Now, the Buhari government got to a point where it put its foot down and said, no, we don't think so. We can go to a regular court and prove that this matter, this contract, and then the default of the contract and so on and so forth was obtained by fraud, which is typically one of the ways of proving, of overturning an arbitral award, or of proving, what's the word I'm looking for now? Or of arguing for the vitiation of a contract, right? Of arguing that the contract in itself was not legal. So this is where I want to draw a correlation to what went on in Nigeria at the Supreme Court last week. While we went to the English court, we now adduced evidence that was not available at the time of the arbitral proceedings, i.e. that the contract was obtained by fraud. By the time we began trial at the English court or arguments at the English court, we had arrested, EFCC had arrested and had begun prosecuting people in Nigeria for fraud. We now took evidence from that was gotten after the original arbitral award and went to the English court and presented that before the court. The court now considered that that new information, that new evidence, and then overturned the original arbitral award. Does this sound shockingly similar to a judgment that we just received from the Supreme Court, where evidence that was not available at the time of the trial, court of trial at the court of first instance, suddenly became available? Does it not suddenly? Do you see the? If we had taken a strict insistence on technicalities, the way the Nigerian court did in the election petitions of last week, do we think we would have gotten an overturning of that arbitral award in the UK? There's obviously a greater premium placed on doing substantive justice than on placing reliance on technicalities. And I quickly just want to point out how the people who did not, I don't even know if they even noticed it, or who did not appreciate that, oh, Nigeria won its case because we supplied evidence at a different level that was not available at the time of the original arbitral proceedings. And that got us out of the quagmire. People who are celebrating that are coming and are also celebrating where we were being told that in spite of rules of court and several years of precedence, they were not going to accept new information into evidence, and we're not going to place any reliance on it for the purposes of resolving our presidential election petition. It makes me wonder, and I quickly just wanted to draw that to draw attention to that. But coming back to the substantive issue, I commend President Buhari. One of the few times that I have done so in his over 40 years or how many years in Nigerian public service, I commend him for standing his ground. That arbitral award would have, if it had been upheld, it probably would have shaken this country to its foundations, seeing as the 11 billion which it accrued to at this time is already what, maybe 30% of our foreign reserves, and would have just sunk us even further into an economic quagmire. So yes, I commend him. I congratulate the country, because God knows that we've been in need of some good news. That matter isn't over. There's a part of it where it says that, they have to determine whether they will, repudiate the award completely whether completely or in part, or they will go back. I think they're supposed to take further arguments on another level of it. I think we should still keep our eyes out on that matter. Now, there was a part of it that really struck me. When Mr. Justice Knowles said that he noticed that arguments had been given by the Nigerian side that contended that the lawyer who had handled the initial award, Mr. Shupo Shashore, SAN, a lawyer for whom he's such a fine gentleman, he has such a crystal legal mind, for whom I have a lot of respect, that Mr. Shupo Shashore, I've never only ever met him in formal circles, I don't think he will ever remember my name or my face, but that the Nigerian side had given arguments alleging that Mr. Shashore was corrupt and that he participated in corrupt dealings. I was very happy to read the court clear him of all those allegations, set the record straight that he had continually argued for the Nigerian side. He had continually argued against the award. And to further prove that there was no substance to the allegations of corruption against him, that the Nigerian government had continued to give him work in other arbitral proceedings where they paid him fees in millions of dollars. And Mr. Justice Knowles had asked the questions, hold on, if you people are saying this man is corrupt, how come you people were giving him other briefs and paying him fees in these sums of money? It obviously means that you truly don't believe that he was corrupt, or you guys are trying to play a fast one. I'm very grateful that he got his name cleared. Again, like I said, never met him before in private. He's just a person who I have the privilege of reading about, and I just really appreciate his work, and he's finally gone. And I thought that was a really nice part of that thing where, he at least was able to get his name cleared. So yeah, again, congratulations to the country, commendations to former President Muhammadu Buhari. Yeah.
Thank you, Ilemona. Eluka, the final question on this issue goes to you. The ruling was quite concerning from my perspective, because on the one hand, the judge seemed to be implying that he was the one that seemed to be doing all the work, trying to get justice for Nigeria. Whilst on the other hand, a number of officials within the Nigerian government were actively working with the plaintiffs, that's PIND, to sabotage the case. And the profile of the individuals involved indicated that some of them seemed to have links to the former petroleum minister, Ridwanu Lukman, who is dead. The head of legal is apparently dead as well. Grace Tega, who was also allegedly involved in the scam, is also dead. But Eruka, are you not concerned that these officials did not seem to be bothered about the cost to Nigeria of their participation in this scam, Eruka?
Sorry, I'm here. So, I think that I mean I share your I share your concerns. And I think the big problem for us as Nigeria, as a big problem for us as a country, that there seems to be this what I call it consensus around government officials to always want to rip the country off. You know, there's always one bracket or there's always one scam. At times you have to question the loyalty of people who are supposed to work on behalf of government or who are supposed to represent government. I mean, you can actually clearly see that this whole PID thing was orchestrated by people who had access to powerful people in government. In fact, in some cases, you have people who were in government working against the interests of the federal government. And I mean, this is just the anyhowness of Nigeria. You know, where people cannot be entrusted to do their address to perform their jobs and duties with an atom of honesty. You know, I mean, I read the case and I was shocked. I'm like, how? Why is someone in the legal department giving PIMD this kind of, I mean, the missiles to attack Nigeria? You know, I mean, I'm grateful for the judge. I mean, and see, that's the point. We got justice because we went to an English court. An English judge took the pains, did the fact-finding mission for Nigeria. To see, I mean, why, how, and we got justice. I mean, I hope the Nigerian government and the judiciary in Nigeria looks at this case and say, man, we have to do right. We have to be the kind of judicial system that goes the extra mile to ensure that justice is, even if it's not served, is deemed to be served. And the point about super should impressive again. Because in George, you have to look at all matters at hand, circumstantial, non-circumstantial, and say, based on fair judge, based on this, can we say this happened? You know, it's I don't know. I don't know. I mean, like when I talk about Nigeria, just get we can't get the basics right. You don't know who's for you and who's against you. You know, there has to be a point where we all collectively agree. There has to be a consensus saying we have to start doing things the right way, if not for ourselves, for the next generation of people. We have to. I mean, it's unfortunate.
Thank you, Eluka. I just find it interesting from reading the ruling that Felix, your friend Abubakar Malami, seems to have exposed himself again because the judge said the Malami's argument made no sense. On the one hand, the Nigerian government was alleging that Supo Sasare was corrupt, but on the other hand, Malami was still giving Supo Sasare judicial legal instructions, getting him to act for Nigeria in a number of other cases and arbitrations. So it appears that Malami's inconsistent approach to his work was one of the things that got Sasare off the hook. But anyway, our time is up, but I must thank our. Oh, sorry.
We all know that if there was a court for Malami somewhere in that judgment, they wouldn't have gone to go and push against it. But anyways, Nigeria is the winner here. So that's the most important thing.
Oh yes, well, yes, we shall see that. We know there's another big arbitration ongoing. That's the Sunrise Power, also involving Nigeria, and a company also alleging that we breached the terms of an investment or an agreement. So we shall see how that goes. But first of all, as I
And
said.
that's an important point that you raised, Michael, because I think, and sorry, I know we're over time, but the reason why we have these things is because every successive government that comes into power comes with characters that think that they can undo what has happened so that they can create opportunities for themselves. You know, I mean, so I saw a tweet today, from Asemota, where he was talking about somebody who was telling him about chaos being a moat and how, you know, Nigerians enjoy the chaos because that's how they make bank in this country. And this that's part of what is leading to all this different arbitration of all the, there's a lack of sanctity of contracts, which again leads us back to our judicial system and the dysfunction that is there, deliberate dysfunction. And that's why you see people, you know, thinking they can just overturn things or, as in the case with PNID, you know, put things into legal agreements, landmines that you know, will put Nigeria in trouble because you expect that there will be a need to, you know, go and go to arbitration and make money that way rather than, you know, have an economic event that leads to benefit for everyone. So there's a lot that we have to fix. And but if you're not even having good elections in the first place, how can you fix such things? That is the issue. If you do not have legitimate government, if you don't have a legitimate electoral process, if you don't have a judiciary that will stick to, that will protect the rule of law, how can you then have progress, development, economic activity? Because nobody trusts that business can be done in this country.
To piggyback off of that, yeah, and to go to Eluka's very first statement, you know, the questions that you asked him at the beginning. There's a reason when you asked him about the effect of these things, the effect these things have on us, on Nigeria as a whole, and the appraisal that the international community and the international business community have of Nigeria. If you see, and Eluka said, you know, something about distrust and how we, you know, it affects our image and our ability to do things. If you read contracts done with Nigeria or with Nigerian companies by their foreign counterparts, you will see the insertion of clauses that make no sense elsewhere, but only in the relation to their dealings with Nigeria. Simply because, like Michael said, there's a lack of sanctity of contract. And looking at us from with our reputation of our inability to deliver and all those other things, we see clauses in contracts that are predicated on an expectation that if our contracting partners do their part, the Nigerian government might or will likely fail to do its part, and then they would have suffered for some loss. And so they put some protective clauses here, there, and everywhere that they typically won't put elsewhere. Now, that clause that Michael, that Phoenix referred to, the one that said if Nigeria does, and the one that gave rise to this entire issue in the first place, was a default clause that if you do not perform your obligations, you will be made to suffer X amount of liability. That's the root cause of this whole thing. But in actual fact, that clause is rooted in Nigeria's deep-seated, very well-known reputation for an inability to perform its obligations under contracts. That's what brought us here in the first place. If the Nigerian government was performing its obligations and PNID didn't, we probably would have been the ones who would have been chasing them around the world, seeking to win an award from them. The only reason why they were able to climb up on a soapbox and shake their fists and demand any monies was because typically of the Federal Republic of Nigeria, we had an obligation under a contract and we did not meet our obligations. Unless and until we change that, we will continue dealing with such clauses in contracts and we will continue dealing with arbitral awards such as this. Like Mr. Justice Knowles said, there is still a $6.2 billion arbitral proceedings where Shupo Shashore is representing the federal government of Nigeria. And again, it all goes back down to the same thing. Failure to perform our obligations under contract. And it's just a terrible thing. It gets us into all sorts of problems.
Thank you. Thank you, Lemona. And as I said before, we hope that the ruling in the Sunrise Power arbitration is not goes in Nigeria's favor. But until the same time next week, because of time, I must wish all of you a fantastic 7 days.
Thanks, Michael. And
thank you, Michael. Thanks.
Thanks, Eloka. Thanks, Lemona, for joining us. And thank you, listeners. Have a great week ahead.
Eloka, you will not thank me. No.